with springtime.
As he breathed the atmosphere of the place, Covenant felt his chest ache with a familiar grief at his own sickness. To ease the pressure in his chest, he moved forward. The grass under his feet was so thick and springy that he could feel it through the strained ligaments of his knees and calves. It seemed to encourage him toward the stream, toward the cleansing of his hurts. The water was sure to be cold, but that did not concern him. His hands were too numb to notice cold very quickly. Squatting on a flat stone beside the stream, he plunged them into the current and began rubbing them together. His wrists felt the chill at once, but his fingers were vague about the water, and it gave him no pain to scrub roughly at his cuts and scrapes. He was marginally aware that Lena had moved away from him up the stream, apparently looking for something, but he was too preoccupied to wonder what she was doing. After an intense scrubbing, he let his hands rest and rolled up his sleeves to inspect his elbows. They were red and sore, but the skin was not broken. When he pulled up his pant legs, he found that his shins and knees were more battered. The discoloration of his bruises was already darkening and would be practically black before long, but the tough fabric of his trousers had held, and again the skin was unbroken. In their way, bruises were as dangerous to him as cuts, but he could not treat them without medication. He made an effort to stifle his anxiety and turned his attention back to his hands. Blood still oozed from the heels and fingertips, and when he washed it off, he could see bits of black grit lodged deep in some of the cuts. But before he started washing again, Lena returned. Her cupped hands were full of thick brown mud. "This is hurt, Loam," she said reverently, as if she were speaking of something rare and powerful. "You must put it on all your wounds." "Mud?" His leper's caution quivered. "I need soap, not more dirt." "This is hurt, Loam," repeated Lena. "It is for healing." She stepped closer and thrust the mud toward him. He thought he could see tiny gleams of gold in it. He stared at it blankly, shocked by the idea of putting mud in his cuts. "You must use it," she insisted. "I know what it is. Do you not understand? This is hurt, Loam. Listen, my father is Trell, Gravelingas of the Rodamarl. His work is with the Firestones, and he leaves healing to the healers. But he is a Rodamarl. He comprehends the rocks and soils, and he taught me to care for myself when there is need. He taught me the signs and places of Hurtloam. This is healing earth. You must use it." "Mud," he glared. "In my cuts? Do you want to cripple me?" Before he could stop her, Lena knelt in front of him and dropped a handful of the mud onto his bare knee. With that hand free, she spread the brown loam down his shin. Then she scooped up the remainder and put it on his other knee and shin. As it lay on his legs, its golden gleaming seemed to grow stronger, brighter. The wet earth was cool and soothing, and it seemed to stroke his legs tenderly, absorbing the pain from his bruises. He watched it closely. The relief that it sent flowing through his bones gave him a pleasure that he had never felt before. Bemused, he opened his hands to Lena, let her spread hurt loam over all his cuts and scrapes. At once, the relief began to run up into him through his elbows and wrists, and an odd tingling started in his palms, as if the hurt loam were venturing past his cuts into his nerves, trying to reawaken them. A similar tingling danced across the arches of his feet. He stared at the glittering mud with a kind of awe in his eyes. It dried quickly. Its light vanished into the brown. In a few moments, Lena rubbed it off his legs. Then he saw that his bruises were almost gone. They were in the last faded yellow stages of healing. He slapped his hands into the stream, washed away the mud, looked at his fingers. They had become whole again. The heels of his hands were healed as well, and the abrasions on his forearms had disappeared completely. He was so stunned that for a moment he could only gape at his hands and think, hellfire. Hellfire and bloody damnation. What's happening to me? After a long silence, he whispered, that's not possible. In response, Lena grinned broadly. What's so funny? Trying to imitate his tone, she said, I need soap, not more dirt. Then she laughed, a teasing sparkle in her eyes. But Covenant was too full of surprise to be distracted. I'm serious. How can this happen? Lena dropped her eyes and answered quietly, there is power in the earth. Power and life. You must know this. Atiar and my mother says that such things as Hurtloam, such powers and mysteries are in all the earth. But we are blind to them because we do not share enough with the land and with each other. There are other things like this? Many. But I know only a few. If you travel to the council, it may be that the lords will teach you everything. But come, she swung lightly to her feet. Here is another. Are you hungry? As if cued by her question, an impression of emptiness opened in his stomach. How long had it been since he had eaten? He adjusted his pant legs, rolled down his sleeves, and shrugged himself to his feet. His wonder was reinforced to find that almost every ache was gone from his muscles. Shaking his head in disbelief, he followed Lena toward one side of the valley. Under the shade of the trees, she stopped beside a gnarled, waist-high shrub. Its leaves were spread and pointed like a holly's, but it was scattered with small viridian blooms, and nestled under some of the leaves were tight clusters of a blue-green fruit the size of blueberries. This is Aliantha, said Lena. We call them treasure berries. Breaking off a cluster, she ate four or five berries, then dropped the seeds into her hand and threw them behind her. It is said that a person can walk the whole length and breadth of the land eating only treasure berries and return home stronger and better fed than before. They are a great gift of the earth. They bloom and bear fruit in all seasons. There is no part of the land in which they do not grow, except perhaps in the east, on the spoiled plains. And they are the hardiest of growing things, the last to die and the first to grow again. All this my mother told me, as part of the lore of our people. Eat, she said, handing Covenant a cluster of the berries. Eat and spread the seeds over the earth so that the Aliantha may flourish. But Covenant made no move to take the fruit. He was lost in wonder, in unanswerable questions about the strange potency of this land. For the moment, he neglected his danger. Lena regarded his unfocused gaze, then took one of the berries and put it in his mouth. By reflex, he broke the skin with his teeth. At once, his mouth was filled with a light, sweet taste like that of a ripe peach faintly blended with salt and lime. In another moment, he was eating greedily, only occasionally remembering to spit out the seeds. He ate until he could find no more fruit on that bush, then looked about him for another. But Lena put her hand on his arm to stop him. Treasure berries are strong food, she said. You do not need many. And the taste is better if you eat slowly. But Covenant was still hungry. He could not remember ever wanting food as much as he now wanted that fruit. The sensations of eating had never been so vivid, so compulsory. He snatched his arm away as if he meant to strike her, then abruptly caught himself. What is this? What's happening? Before he could pursue the question, he became aware of another feeling. Overpowering drowsiness. In the space of one instant, he passed almost without transition from hunger to a huge yawn that made him seem top-heavy with weariness. He tried to turn and stumbled. Lena was saying, the Hurtloam does this, but I did not expect it. When the wounds are very deadly, Hurtlum brings sleep to speed the healing. But cuts on the hands are not deadly. Do you have hurts that you did not show me? Yes, he thought through another yawn. I'm sick to death. He was asleep before he hit the grass. When he began to drift slowly awake, the first thing that he became conscious of was Lena's firm thighs pillowing his head. Gradually, he grew aware of other things. The tree shade bedizened with glints of declining sunlight, the aroma of pine, the wind murmuring, the grass thickly cradling his body, the sound of a tune, the irregular tingling that came and went from his palms like an atavism. But the warmth of his cheek on Lena's lap seemed more important. For the time, his sole desire was to clasp Lena in his arms and bury his face in her thighs. He resisted it by listening to her song. In a soft and somehow naive tone, she sang, "Something there is in beauty, which grows in the soul of the beholder like a flower. Fragile, for many are the blights which may waste the beauty or the beholder, and imperishable, for the beauty may die, or the beholder may die, or the world may die, but the soul in which the flower grows survives." Her voice folded him in a comfortable spell which he did not want to end. After a pause full of the scent of pine and the whispering breeze, he said softly, "I like that."
"Do you? I am glad. It was made by Tomal the craftmaster for the dance when he wed Imoiran, Moiran daughter. But oft times the beauty of a song is in the singing, and I am no singer. It may be that tonight Atiaran, my mother, will sing for the stone down. Then you will hear a real song."
Covenant gave no answer. He lay still, only wishing to nestle in his pillow for as long as he could. The tingling in his palms seemed to urge him to embrace Lena, and he lay still, enjoying the desire and wondering where he would find the courage. Then she began to sing again. The tune sounded familiar, and behind it he heard the rumor of dark wings. Suddenly he realized that it was very much like the tune that went with Golden Boy. He had been walking down the sidewalk toward the offices of the phone company, the Bell Telephone Company. That name was written in gilt letters on the door to pay his bill in person. He jerked off Lena's lap, jumped to his feet. A mist of violence dimmed his vision. "What song is that?" he demanded thickly. Startled, Lena answered,
"No song. I was only trying to make a melody. Is it wrong?"
The tone of her voice steadied him. She sounded so abandoned, so made forlorn by his quick anger. Words failed him, and the mist passed. "No business," he thought. "I've got no business taking it out on her." Extending his hands, he helped her to her feet. He tried to smile, but his stiff face could only grimace. "Where do we go now?" Slowly the hurt faded from her eyes.
"You are strange, Thomas Covenant," she said.
Wryly, he replied, "I didn't know it was this bad." For a moment they stood gazing into each other's eyes. Then she surprised him by blushing and dropping his hands. There was a new excitement in her voice as she said,
"We will go to the stone down. You will amaze my mother and father."
Gaily, she turned and ran away down the valley. She was lithe and light and graceful as she ran, and Covenant watched her, musing on the strange new feelings that moved in him. He had an unexpected sense that this land might offer him some spell with which he could conjure away his impotence, some rebirth to which he could cling even after he regained consciousness, after the land and all its insane implications faded into the miasma of half-remembered dreams. Such hope did not require that the land be real. physically actual and independent of his own unconscious, uncontrolled dream-weaving? No. Leprosy was an incurable disease, and if he did not die from his accident, he would have to live with that fact. But a dream might heal other afflictions. It might. He set off after Lena with a swing in his stride and eagerness in his veins. The sun was down far enough in the sky to leave the lower half of the valley in shadow. Ahead of him, he could see Lena beckoning, and he followed the stream toward her, enjoying the spring of the turf under his feet as he walked. He felt somehow taller than before, as if the hurt loam had done more to him than simply heal his cuts and scrapes. Nearing Lena, he seemed to see parts of her for the first time. The delicacy of her ears when her hair swung behind them, the way the soft fabric of her shift hung on her breasts and hips, her slim waist. The sight of her made the tingling in his palms grow stronger. She smiled at him, then led the way along the stream and out of the valley. They moved down a crooked file between sheer walls of rock which climbed above them until the narrow slit of the sky was hundreds of feet away. The trail was rocky, and Covenant had to watch his feet constantly to keep his balance. The effort made the file seem long, but within a couple hundred yards, he and Lena came to a crevice that ascended to the right away from the stream. They climbed into and along the crevice. Soon it leveled, then sloped gradually downward for a long way, but it bent enough so that Covenant could not see where he was headed. At last, the crevice took one more turn and ended, leaving Lena and Covenant on the mountainside high above the river valley. They were facing due west into the declining sun. The river came out of the mountains to their left and flowed away into the plains on their right. There was a branch of the mountain range across the valley, but it soon shrank into the plains to the north.
"Here is the middle," said Lena. "And there is Middle Stone Down."
Covenant saw a tiny knot of huts north of him on the east side of the river.
"It is not a great distance," Lena went on, "but the path travels up the valley and then back along the river. The sun will be gone when we reach our stone down. Come."
Covenant had an uneasy moment looking down the slope of the mountain, still more than 2,000 feet above the valley, but he mastered it and followed Lena to the south. The mountainside relaxed steadily, and soon the path lay along grassy slopes and behind stern rock buttresses, through dells and ravines, among mazes of fallen boulders. And as the trail descended, the air became deeper, softer, and less crystalline. The smells slowly changed, grew greener. Pine and aspen gave way to the loam of the grasslands. Covenant felt that he was alive to every gradation of the change, every nuance of the lowering altitude. Through the excitement of his new alertness, the descent passed quickly. Before he was ready to leave the mountains, the trail rolled down a long hill, found the river, and then swung north along it. The middle was narrow and brisk where the path first joined it, and it spoke with wet rapidity to itself in a voice full of resonances and rumors. But as the river drew toward the plains, it broadened and slowed, became more philosophical in its low, self-communing mutter. Soon its voice no longer filled the air. Quietly, it told itself its long tale as it rolled away on its quest for the sea. Under the spell of the river, Covenant became slowly more conscious of the reassuring solidity of the land. It was not an intangible dreamscape. It was concrete, susceptible to ascertainment. This was an illusion, of course, a trick of his racked and smitten mind. But it was curiously comforting. It seemed to promise that he was not walking into horror, chaos, that this land was coherent, manageable, that when he had mastered its laws, its peculiar facts, he would be able to travel unscathed the path of his dream, retain his grip on his sanity. Such thoughts made him feel almost bold as he followed Lena's lithe back, the swaying appeal of her hips. While Covenant wandered in unfamiliar emotions, the Middle Valley dropped into shadow. The sun crossed behind the western mountains, and though light still glowed on the distant plains, a thin veil of darkness thickened in the valley. As he watched, the rim of the shadow stretched itself high up the mountain on his right, climbing like a hungry tide the shores of day. In the twilight, he sensed his peril sneaking furtively closer to him, though he did not know what it was. Then the last ridge of the mountains fell into dusk, and the glow on the plains began to fade. Lena stopped, touched Covenant's arm, pointed.
"See," she said, "here is Middlestone Down."
They stood atop a long, slow hill, and at its bottom were gathered the buildings of the village. Covenant could see the houses quite clearly, although lights already shone faintly behind some of the windows. Except for a large open circle in the center of the village, the stone down looked as erratically laid out as if it had fallen off the mountain not long ago. But this impression was belied by the smooth sheen of the stone walls and the flat roofs. And when he looked more closely, Covenant saw that the stone down was not, in fact, unorganized. All the buildings faced in toward the center. None of them had more than one story, and all were stone, with flat slabs of rock for roofs. But they varied considerably in size and shape. Some were round, others square or rectangular, and still others so irregular from top to bottom that they seemed more like squat, hollow boulders than buildings. As she and Covenant started down toward the stone down, Lena said,
"Five times 100 people of the South Plains live here. Rodamarl, shepherds, cattle herds, farmers, and those who craft. But Atiaran, my mother alone, has been to the Lor's Rot."
Pointing, she added,
"The home of my family is there, nearest the river."
Walking together, she and Covenant skirted the stone down toward her home. Chapter 6. Legend of Beric Halfhand. Dusk was deepening over the valley. Birds gathered to rest for the night in the trees of the foothills. They sang and called energetically to each other for a while, but their high din soon relaxed into a quiet, satisfied murmur. As Lena and Covenant passed behind the outer houses of the stone down, they could again hear the river contemplating itself in the distance. Lena was silent, as if she were containing some excitement or agitation, and Covenant was too immersed in the twilight sounds around him to say anything. The swelling night seemed full of soft communions, anodynes for the loneliness of the dark. So they came, quietly, toward Lena's home. It was a rectangular building, larger than most in the stone down, but with the same polished sheen on the walls. A warm yellow light radiated from the windows. As Lena and Covenant approached, a large figure crossed one of the windows and moved toward a farther room. At the corner of the house, Lena paused to take Covenant's hand and squeezed it before she led him up to the doorway. The entry was covered with a heavy curtain. She held it aside and drew him into the house. There, she halted. Looking around swiftly, he observed that the room they had entered went the depth of the house, but it had two curtained doors in either wall. In it, a stone table and benches with enough space to seat 6 or 8 people occupied the middle of the floor. But the room was large enough so that the table did not dominate it. Cut into the rock walls all around the room were shelves, and these were full of stoneware jars and utensils, some obviously for use in cooking and eating, others with functions which Covenant could not guess. Several rock stools stood against the walls, and the warm yellow light filled the chamber, glowing on the smooth surfaces and reflecting off rare colors and textures in the stone. The light came from fires in several stone pots, one in each corner of the room and one in the center of the table. But there was no flicker of flames. The light was as steady as its stone containers. And with the light came a soft smell as of newly broken earth. After only a cursory glance around the chamber, Covenant's attention was drawn to the far end of the room. There on a slab of stone against the wall sat a huge granite pot, half as tall as a man. And over the pot, peering intently at its contents, stood a large man, a great pillar of a figure as solid as a boulder. He had his back to Lena and Covenant and did not seem to be aware of them. He wore a short brown tunic with brown trousers under it, but the leaf pattern woven into the fabric at his shoulders was identical to Lena's. Under the tunic, his massive muscles bunched and stretched as he rotated the pot. It looked prodigiously heavy, but Covenant half expected the man to lift it over his head to pour out its contents. There was a shadow over the pot which the brightness of the room did not penetrate, and for some time the man stared into the darkness, studying it while he rotated the pot. Then he began to sing. His voice was too low for Covenant to make out the words, but as he listened, he felt a kind of invocation in the sound, as if the contents of the pot were powerful. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the shadow began to pale. At first, Covenant thought that the light in the room had changed, but soon he saw a new illumination starting from the pot. The glow swelled and deepened, and at last shone out strongly, making the other lights seem thin. With a final mutter over his work, the man stood upright and turned around. In the new brightness, he seemed even taller and broader than before, as if his limbs and shoulders and deep chest drew strength, stature from the light, and his forehead was ruddy from the heat of the pot. Seeing Covenant, he started in surprise. An uneasy look came into his eyes, and his right hand touched his thick, reddish beard. Then he extended the hand, palm forward, toward Covenant, and said to Lena, "Well, daughter, you bring a guest. But I remember that our hospitality is in your charge today." The strange potency of a moment before was gone from his voice. He sounded like a man who did not speak much with people. But though he was treating his daughter sternly, he seemed essentially calm. "You know I promised more graveling today, and Atiyaran, your mother, is helping deliver the new child of Odana Murinmate. The guest will be offended by our hospitality, with no meal ready to welcome the end of his day." Yet while he reprimanded Lena, his eyes studied Covenant cautiously. Lena bowed her head, trying, Covenant felt sure, to look ashamed for her father's benefit. But a moment later, she hurried across the room and hugged the big man. He smiled softly at her upturned face. Then, turning toward Covenant, she announced, "Trell, my father, I bring a stranger to the Stone Down. I found him on Kevin's watch." A lively gleam shone in her eyes, although she tried to keep her voice formal. "So," Trell responded, "a stranger, that I see, and wonder what business took him to that ill-blown place." "He fought with a gray cloud," answered Lena. Looking at this bluff, hale man, whose muscle-knotted arm rested with such firm gentleness on Lena's shoulder, Covenant expected him to laugh at the absurd suggestion. A man fighting a cloud. Trell's presence felt imperturbable and earthy, like an assertion of common sense that reduced the nightmare of foul to its proper unreality. So Covenant was put off his balance by hearing Trell ask with perfect seriousness, "Which was the victor?" The question forced Covenant to find a new footing for himself. He was not prepared to deal with the memory of Lord Fowl, but at the same time he felt obscurely sure that he could not lie to Trell. He found that his throat had gone dry, and he answered awkwardly, "I lived through it." Trell said nothing for a moment, but in the silence Covenant felt that his answer had increased the big man's uneasiness. Trell's eyes shifted away, then came back as he said, "I see. And what is your name, stranger?" Promptly, Lena smiled at Covenant and answered for him, "Thomas Covenant. Covenant of Kevin's Watch."
"What, girl?" asked Trell. "Are you a prophet that you speak for someone higher than you?"
Then to Covenant he said, "Well, Thomas Covenant of Kevin's Watch, do you have other names?" Covenant was about to respond negatively when he caught an eager interest in the question from Lena's eyes. He paused. In a leap of insight, he realized that he was as exciting to her as if he had in fact been Beric Halfhand, that to her yearning toward mysteries and powers, all-knowing lords and battles in the clouds, his strangeness and his unexplained appearance on the watch made him seem like a personification of great events out of a heroic past. The message of her gaze was suddenly plain. In the suspense of her curiosity, she was hanging from the hope that he would reveal himself to her, give her some glimpse of his high calling to appease her for her youth and ignorance. The idea filled him with strange reverberations. He was not used to such flattery. It gave him an unfamiliar sense of possibility. Quickly he searched for some high-sounding title to give himself, some name by which he could please Lena without falsifying himself to Trell. Then he had an inspiration. Thomas Covenant, he said, as if he were rising to a challenge. The Unbeliever. Immediately, he felt that with that name he had committed himself to more than he could measure at present. The act made him feel pretentious, but Lena rewarded him with a beaming glance, and Trell accepted the statement gravely. "Well, Thomas Covenant," he replied, "you are welcome to Mithilstone Down. Please accept the hospitality of this home. I must go now to take my graveling, as I promised. It may be that Atiaran, my wife, will return soon. And if you prod her, Lena may remember to offer you refreshment while I am gone." While he spoke, Trell turned back to his stone pot. He wrapped his arms about it, lifted it from its base. With red-gold flames reflecting a dance in his hair and beard, he carried the pot toward the doorway. Lena hurried ahead of him to hold open the curtain, and in a moment Trell was gone, leaving Covenant with one glimpse of the contents of the pot. It was full of small, round stones like fine gravel, and they seemed to be on fire.
"Damnation," Covenant whispered. "How heavy is that thing?"
"Three men cannot lift the pot alone," replied Lena proudly. "But when the graveling burns, my father may lift it easily. He is a gravelingas of the Rotamarl, deep with the lore of stone."
Covenant stared after him for a moment, appalled by Trell's strength. Then Lena said,
"Now, I must not fail to offer you refreshment. Will you wash or bathe? Are you thirsty? We have good spring wine."
Her voice brought back the scintillation of Covenant's nerves. His instinctive distrust of Trell's might dissipated under the realization that he had a power of his own. This world accepted him. It accorded him importance. People like Trell and Lena were prepared to take him as seriously as he wanted. All he had to do was keep moving, follow the path of his dream to Revelstone. Whatever that was. He felt giddy at the prospect. On the impetus of the moment, he determined to participate in his own importance, enjoy it while it lasted. To cover his rush of new emotions, he told Lena that he would like to wash. She took him past a curtain into another room where water poured continuously from a spout in the wall. A sliding stone valve sent the water into either a wash basin or a large tub, both formed of stone. Lena showed him some fine sand to use as soap, then left him. The water was cold, but he plunged his hands and head into it with something approaching enthusiasm. When he was done, he looked around for a towel but did not see one. Experimentally, he eased a hand over the glowing pot that lit the room. The warm yellow light dried his fingers rapidly, so he leaned over the pot, rubbing the water from his face and neck, and soon even his hair was dry. By force of habit, he went through his VSE, examining the nearly invisible marks where his hands had been cut. Then he pushed the curtain out of his way and re-entered the central chamber. He found that another woman had joined Lena. As he returned, he heard Lena say,
"He says he knows nothing of us."
Then the other woman looked at him, and he guessed immediately that she was Atiaran. The leaf pattern at the shoulders of her long brown robe seemed to be a kind of family emblem. He did not need such hints to see the long familiarity in the way the older woman touched Lena's shoulder, or the similarities in their posture. But where Lena was fresh and slim of line, full of unbroken newness, Atyaran appeared complex, almost self-contradictory. Her soft surface, her full figure, she carried as if it were a hindrance to the hard strength of experience within her, as if she lived with her body on the basis of an old and difficult truce. And her face bore the signs of that truce. Her forehead seemed prematurely lined, and her deep, spacious eyes appeared to open inward on a weary battleground of doubts and uneasy reconciliations. Looking at her over the stone table, Covenant received a double impression of a frowning concern, the result of knowing and fearing more than other people realized, and an absent beauty that would rekindle her face if only she would smile. After a brief hesitation, the older woman touched her heart and raised her hand toward Covenant as Trell had done.
Hail, guest, and welcome. I am Atyaran Trellmate. I have spoken with Trell, and with Lena, my daughter. You need no introduction to me, Thomas Covenant. Be comfortable in our home. Remembering his manners and his new determination, Covenant responded, I'm honored.
Atyaran bowed slightly.
Accepting that which is offered honors the giver, and courtesy is always welcome.
Then she seemed to hesitate again, uncertain of how to proceed. Covenant watched the return of old conflicts to her eyes, thinking that gaze would have an extraordinary power if it were not so inward. But she reached her decision soon and said,
It is not the custom of our people to worry a guest with hard questions before eating. But the food is not ready.
She glanced at Lena.
And you are strange to me, Thomas Covenant. Strange and disquieting. I would talk with you, if I may, while Lena prepares what food we have. You seem to bear a need that should not wait.
Covenant shrugged noncommittally. He felt a twinge of anxiety at the thought of her questions and braced himself to try to answer them without losing his new balance. In the pause, Lena began moving around the room. She went to the shelves to get plates and bowls for the table and prepared some dishes on a slab of stone heated from underneath by a tray of graveling. She turned her eyes toward Covenant often as she moved, but he did not always notice. Atyaran compelled his attention. At first, she murmured uncertainly,
I hardly know where to begin. It has been so long, and I learned so little of what the lords know. But what I have must be enough. No one here can take my place.
She straightened her shoulders.
May I see your hands?
Remembering Lena's initial reaction to him, Covenant held up his right hand. Atyaran moved around the table until she was close enough to touch him, but did not. Instead, she searched his face.
Half hand. It is as Trell said. And some say that Beric Earthfriend, Hearthew, and Lord Fatherer will return to the land when there is need. Do you know these things?
Covenant answered gruffly, No. Still looking into his face, Atyaran said,
Your other hand.
Puzzled, he raised his left. She dropped her eyes to it. When she saw it, she gasped and bit her lip and stepped back. For an instant, she seemed inexplicably terrified. But she mastered herself and asked with only a low tremble in her voice,
What metal is that ring?
What? This?
Her reaction startled Covenant, and in his surprise he gaped at a complicated memory of Joan saying,
With this ring I thee wed,
and the old ochre-robed beggar replying,
Be true, be true.
Darkness threatened him. He heard himself answer as if he were someone else, someone who had nothing to do with leprosy and divorce. It's white gold. Atiaran groaned, clamped her hands over her temples as if she were in pain. But again she brought herself under control, and a bleak courage came into her eyes. "I alone," she said. "I alone in Mithilstone Down know the meaning of this. Even Trell has not this knowledge. And I know too little. Answer, Thomas Covenant. Is it true?"
"I should have thrown it away," he muttered bitterly. "A leper's got no right to be sentimental."
But Atiaran's intensity drew his attention toward her again. She gave him the impression that she knew more about what was happening to him than he did, that he was moving into a world which, in some dim, ominous way, had been made ready for him. His old anger mounted.
"Of course it's true," he snapped. "What's the matter with you? It's only a ring."
"It is white gold."
Atiaran's reply sounded as forlorn as if she had just suffered a bereavement.
"So what?"
He could not understand what distressed the woman.
"It doesn't mean a thing."
Joan had preferred it to yellow gold, but that had not prevented her from divorcing him.
"It is white gold," Atiaran repeated. "The lords sing an ancient lore song concerning the bearer of white gold. I remember only a part of it, thus. And he who wields white, wild magic gold is a paradox, for he is everything and nothing, hero and fool, potent, helpless, and with the one word of truth or treachery, he will save or damn the earth, because he is mad and sane, cold and passionate, lost and found. Do you know the song, Covenant? There is no white gold in the land. Gold has never been found in the earth, though it is said that Beric knew of it and made the songs. You come from another place. What terrible purpose brings you here?"
Covenant felt her searching him with her eyes for some flaw, some falsehood which would give the lie to her fear. He stiffened.
"You have might," the despiser had said. "Wild magic. You will never know what it is."
The idea that his wedding band was some kind of talisman nauseated him like the smell of attar. He had a savage desire to shout,
"None of this is happening."
But he only knew of one workable response. "Don't think about it. Follow the path. Survive." He met Atiaran on her own ground.
"All purposes are terrible. I have a message for the Council of Lords."
"What message?" she demanded.
After only an instant's hesitation, he grated,
"The Grey Slayer has come back."
When she heard Covenant pronounce that name, Lena dropped the stoneware bowl she was carrying and fled into her mother's arms. Covenant stood glowering at the shattered bowl. The liquid it had contained gleamed on the smooth stone floor. Then he heard Atiaran pant in horror.
"How do you know this?"
He looked back at her and saw the two women clinging together like children threatened by the demon of their worst dreams.
"Leper, outcast, unclean," he thought sourly.
But as he watched, Atiaran seemed to grow solider, her jaw square, her broad glance hardened. For all her fear, she was a strong woman comforting her child, and bracing herself to meet her danger. Again she asked,
"How do you know?"
She made him feel defensive, and he replied,
"I met him on Kevin's watch."
"Alas," she cried, hugging Lena. "Alas for the young in this world. The doom of the land is upon them. Generations will die in agony, and there will be war and terror and pain for those who live. Alas, Lena, my daughter, you were born into an evil time, and there will be no peace or comfort for you when the battle comes. Ah, Lena. Lena.
Her grief touched an undefended spot in Covenant, and his throat thickened. Her voice filled his own image of the land's desolation with a threnody he had not heard before. For the first time, he sensed that the land held something precious which was in danger of being lost. This combination of sympathy and anger tightened his nerves still further. He vibrated to a sharper pitch, trembled. When he looked at Lena, he saw that a new awe of him had already risen above her panic. The young conscious offer in her eyes burned more disturbingly than ever. He held himself still until Atiyaran and Lena slowly released each other. Then he asked, "What do you know about all this? About what's happening to me?" Before Atiyaran could reply, a voice called from outside the house, "Hail! Atiyaran, Tiaran daughter! Trell Gravelingus tells us that your work is done for this day. Come and sing to the stone down." For a moment, Atiyaran stood still, shrinking back into herself. Then she sighed. "Ah, the work of my life has just begun," and turned to the door. Holding aside the curtain, she said into the night, "We have not yet eaten. I will come later. But after the gathering, I must speak with the Circle of Elders." "They will be told," the voice answered.
"Good," said Atiyaran.
But instead of returning to Covenant, she remained in the doorway, staring into the darkness for a while. When she closed the curtain at last and faced Covenant, her eyes were moist, and they held a look that he at first thought was defeat. But then he realized that she was only remembering defeat.
"No, Thomas Covenant," she said sadly. "I know nothing of your fate. Perhaps if I had remained at the Lore's Rot longer, if I had had the strength. But I passed my limit there and came home. I know a part of the old lore that Mithil Stonedown does not guess, but it is too little. All that I can remember for you are hints of a wild magic which destroys peace. Wild magic graven in every rock, contained for white gold to unleash or control. But the meaning of such lines, or the courses of these times, I do not know. That is a double reason to take you to the council."
Then she looked squarely into his face and added, "I tell you openly, Thomas Covenant, if you have come to betray the land, only the lords may hope to stop you." Betray? This was another new thought. An instant passed before he realized what Atiyaran was suggesting. But before he could protest, Lena put in for him,
"Mother, he fought a gray cloud on Kevin's watch. I saw it. How can you doubt him?"
Her defense controlled his belligerent reaction. Without intending to, she had put him on false ground. He had not gone so far as to fight Lord Fowl. Trell's return stopped any reply Atiyaran might have made. The big man stood in the doorway for a moment, looking between Atiyaran and Lena and Covenant. Abruptly he said, "So, we are come on hard times."
"Yes, Trell, my husband," murmured Atiyaran. "Hard times."
Then his eyes caught the shards of stoneware on the floor. "Hard times indeed," he chided gently, "when stoneware is broken and the pieces left to powder underfoot." This time Lena was genuinely ashamed.
"I am sorry, father," she said. "I was afraid."
"No matter." Trell went to her and placed his big hands, light with affection, on her shoulders. "Some wounds may be healed. I feel strong today." At this, Atiyaran gazed gratefully at Trell as if he had just undertaken some heroic task. To Covenant's incomprehension, she said,
"Be seated, guest. Food will be ready soon. Come, Lena."
The two of them began to bustle around the cooking stone. Covenant watched as Trell started to pick up the pieces of the broken pot. The Gravlinger's voice rumbled softly, singing an ancient subterranean song. Tenderly, he carried the shards to the table and set them down near the lamp. Then he seated himself. Covenant sat beside him, wondering what was about to happen. Singing his cavernous song between clenched teeth, Trell began to fit the shards together as if the pot were a puzzle. Piece after piece he set in place, and each piece held where he left it without any adhesive Covenant could see. Trell moved painstakingly, his touch delicate on every fragment, but the pot seemed to grow quickly in his hands, and the pieces fit together perfectly, leaving only a network of fine black lines to mark the breaks. Soon, all the shards were in place. Then his deep tone took on a new cadence. He began to stroke the stoneware with his fingers, and everywhere his touch passed, the black fracture marks vanished as if they had been erased. Slowly, he covered every inch of the pot with his caress. When he had completed the outside, he stroked the inner surface, and finally he lifted the pot, spread his touch over its base. Holding the pot between the fingers of both hands, he rotated it carefully, making sure he had missed nothing. Then he stopped singing, set the pot down gently, took his hands away. It was as complete and solid as if it had never been dropped. Covenant pulled his awed stare away from the pot to Trell's face. The Gravlingas looked haggard with strain, and his taut cheeks were streaked with tears. "Mending is harder than breaking," he mumbled. "I could not do this every day." Wearily, he folded his arms on the table and cradled his head in them. Atiaran stood behind her husband, massaging the heavy muscles of his shoulders and neck, and her eyes were full of pride and love. Something in her expression made Covenant feel that he came from a very poor world, where no one knew or cared about healing stoneware pots. He tried to tell himself that he was dreaming, but he did not want to listen. After a silent pause full of respect for Trell's deed, Lena started to set the table. Soon Atiaran brought bowls of food from the cooking stone. When everything was ready, Trell lifted his head, climbed tiredly to his feet. With Atiaran and Lena, he stood beside the table. Atiaran said to Covenant, "It is the custom of our people to stand before eating, as a sign of our respect for the earth, from which life and food and power come." Covenant stood as well, feeling awkward and out of place. Trell and Atiaran and Lena closed their eyes, bowed their heads for a moment. Then they sat down. When Covenant had followed them to the bench, they began to pass around the food. It was a bountiful meal. There was cold salt beef covered with a steaming gravy, wild rice, dried apples, brown bread, and cheese. And Covenant was given a tall mug of a drink which Lena called spring wine. This beverage was as clear and light as water, slightly effervescent, and it smelled dimly of Alianta. But it tasted like a fine beer which had been cured of all bitterness. Covenant had downed a fair amount of it before he realized that it added a still keener vibration to his already thrumming nerves. He could feel himself tightening. He was too full of unusual pressures. Soon he was impatient for the end of the meal, impatient to leave the house and expand in the night air. But Lena's family ate slowly, and a pall hung over them. They dined as deliberately as if this meal marked the end of all their happiness together. In the silence, Covenant realized that this was a result of his presence. It made him uneasy. To ease himself, he tried to increase what he knew about his situation. "I have a question," he said stiffly. With a gesture, he took in the whole stone down. "No wood. There's plenty of trees all over this valley, but I don't see you using any wood. Are the trees sacred or something?" After a moment, Atiaran replied, "Sacred. I know that word, but its meaning is obscure to me. There is power in the earth,
in trees and rivers and soil and stone, and we respect it for the life it gives. So we have sworn the oath of peace. Is that what you ask? We do not use wood because the wood lore, the Lilianril, is lost to us, and we have not sought to regain it. In the exile of our people, when desolation was upon the land, many precious things were lost. Our people clung to the Rodamara lore in the Southron Range and the Wastes, and it enabled us to endure. The wood lore seemed not to help us, and it was forgotten. Now that we have returned to the land, the stone lore suffices for us. But others have kept the Lilianril. I have seen soaring Woodhelven in the hills far north and east of us, and it is a fair place. Their people understand wood and flourish. There is some trade between Stone Down and Woodhelven, but wood and stone are not traded. When she stopped, Covenant sensed a difference in the new silence. A moment passed before he was sure that he could hear a distant rumor of voices. Shortly, Atiaran confirmed this by saying to Trell,
"Ah,
the gathering. I promised to sing tonight." She and Trell stood together, and he said, "So. And then you will speak with the Circle of Elders. Some preparations for tomorrow I will make. See," he pointed at the table, "it will be a fine day. There is no shadow on the Heart of the Stone." Almost in spite of himself, Covenant looked where Trell pointed, but he could see nothing. Noticing his blank look, Atiaran said kindly, "Do not be surprised, Thomas Covenant. No one but a Rodamaril can foretell weather in such stones as this. Now come with me, if you will, and I will sing the legend of Beric Halfhand." As she spoke, she took the pot of graveling from the table to carry with her. "Lena, will you clean the stoneware?" Covenant got to his feet. Glancing at Lena, he saw her face twisted with unhappy obedience. She clearly wanted to go with them. But Trell also saw her expression and said, "Accompany our guest, Lena, my daughter. I will not be too busy to care for the stoneware." Pleasure transformed her instantly, and she leaped up to throw her arms around her father's neck. He returned her embrace for a moment, then lowered her to the floor. She straightened her shift, trying to look suddenly demure, and move to her mother's side. Atiaran said, "Trell, you will teach this girl to think she is a queen." But she took Lena's hand to show that she was not angry, and together they went past the curtain. Covenant followed promptly, went out of the house into the starry night with a sense of release. There was more room for him to explore himself under the open sky. He needed exploration. He could not understand, rationalize his mounting excitement. The spring wine he had consumed seemed to provide a focus for his energies. It capered in his veins like a raving satyr. He felt inexplicably brutalized by inspiration, as if he were the victim rather than the source of his dream. "White gold," he sputtered at the darkness between the houses. "Wild magic. Do they think I'm crazy?" Perhaps he was crazy. Perhaps he was at this moment wandering in dementia, tormenting himself with false griefs and demands, the impositions of an illusion. Such things had happened to lepers. "I'm not," he shouted, almost cried out aloud. "I know the difference. I know I'm dreaming." His fingers twitched with violence, but he drew cool air deep into his lungs, put everything behind him. He knew how to survive a dream. Madness was the only danger. As they walked together between the houses, Lena's smooth arm brushed his. His skin felt lambent at the touch. The murmur of people grew quickly louder. Soon, Lena, Atiaran, and Covenant reached the circle, moved into the gathering of the Stone Down. It was lit by dozens of handheld graveling pots, and in the illumination Covenant could see clearly. Men, women, and children clustered the rim of the circle.
Covenant guessed that virtually the entire Stone Down had come to hear Atiyaran sing. Most of the people were shorter than he was, and considerably shorter than Trell, and they had dark hair, brown or black, again, unlike Trell. But they were a stocky, broad-shouldered breed, and even the women and children gave an impression of physical strength. Centuries of stonework had shaped them to suit their labor. Covenant felt the same dim fear of them that he had of Trell. They seemed too strong, and he had nothing but his strangeness to protect him if they turned against him. They were busy talking to each other, apparently waiting for Atiyaran, and they gave no sign of noticing Covenant. Reluctant to call attention to himself, he hung back at the outer edges of the gathering. Lena stopped with him. Atiyaran gave her the graveling pot, then moved away through the crowd toward the center of the circle. After he had scanned the assembly, Covenant turned his attention to Lena. She stood by his right side, the top of her head just an inch or two higher than his shoulder, and she held the graveling pot at her waist with both hands so that the light emphasized her breasts. She was clearly unconscious of the effect, but he felt it intensely, and his palms itched again with an eager and fearful desire to touch her. As if she felt his thoughts, she looked up at him with a solemn softness in her face that made his heart lurch as if it were too big for his constraining ribs. Awkwardly, he took his eyes away, stared around the circle without seeing anything. When he glanced back at her, she seemed to be doing just what he had done, pretending to look elsewhere. He tightened his jaw and forced himself to wait for something to happen. Soon the gathering became still. In the center of the open circle, Atiyaran stood up on a low stone platform. She bowed her head to the gathering, and the people responded by silently raising their graveling pots. The lights seemed to focus around her like a penumbra. When the pots were lowered, and a last ripple of shuffling had passed through the gathering, Atiyaran began, "I feel I am an old woman this night. My memory seems clouded, and I do not remember all the song I would like to sing. But what I remember I will sing, and I will tell you the story as I have told it before, so that you may share what lore I have." At this, low laughter ran through the gathering, a humorous tribute to Atiyaran's superior knowledge. She remained silent, her head bowed to hide the fear that knowledge had brought her, until the people were quiet again. Then she raised her eyes and said, "I will sing the legend of Beric Halfhand." After a last momentary pause, she placed her song into the welcoming silence like a rough and rare jewel. "In war, men pass like shadows that stain the grass, leaving their lives upon the green. While earth bewails the crimson sheen, men's dreams and stars and whispers all helpless pass. In one red shadow by woe and wicked cast, in one red pool about his feet, Beric mows the vile like ripe wheat, though of all of beauty's garters he is last. Last to pass into the shadow of defeat, and last to feel the full despair, and leave his weapons lying there, take his half-unhanded hand from battle seat. Across the plains of the land they all swept, treacherous lust at faltering stride, as Beric fled before the tide, till on Mount Thunder's rock-mantled side he wept. Beric, earth friend, help and weal, battle aid against the foe. Earth gives and answers power's peal, ringing earth friend, help and heal, clean the land from bloody death and woe." The song made Covenant quiver, as if it concealed a specter which he should have been able to recognize. But Atiyaran's voice enthralled him. No instruments aided her singing, but before she had finished her first line, he knew that she did not need them. The clean thread of her melody was tapestried with unexpected resonances, implied harmonies, echoes of silent voices, so that on every rising motif she seemed about to expand into three or four singers, throats separate and unanimous in the song. It began in a minor mode that made the gold-hued, star-gemmed night throb like a dirge.